what goes up must come down. Spinning wheel, got to go round. Talking about your troubles, it's a crying sin. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin.
Over the last couple of weeks, stock markets across the globe have shown enormous volatility. So for this week's Please Explain, we will be looking at the stock markets around the world and how they operate and in what ways they are interconnected. And joining me now is John Authors, investment editor for the Financial Times. Welcome to Please Explain.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the basics. Do all of the world's stock markets operate pretty much in the same way?
Almost all of them, yes. I mean, you've got one or two markets which still have more controls over foreign investors, and they therefore tend not to engage in quite the same globalization game as the others. You know, the very significant example there being Shanghai and Shenzhen, the big mainland Chinese exchanges, which to some extent can still tend to occupy their own little bubble. But you know
they're insulated from what happens in most of the other stock markets.
They're insulated from what happens to other stock markets. The only problem is they're also uniquely exposed to the manias of their own retail investors, which is why Shanghai and Shenzhen actually went on a quite historic Nasdaq-like tear last year. But yes, they tend to obey slightly different rules, just something that people have only spent the last year working out. Beyond that, the degree of uniformity, the similarity in the way you see all the different charts move in the same direction in the last few weeks is very striking, but it's actually not that surprising.
When was this first stock market created, do you know?
I think there's an interesting debate for financial historians. Certainly New York and London have been organized in something like the current form for over a century. You've got, you know, the first stock market bubbles you can see happening in London, you know, probably before American independence, the early 1700s, I think. Mm-hmm. No doubt a listener will tell me. I think Dutch tulip mania was sometime in the 1600s, but that wasn't actually a stock market.
But it's the same sort of idea. Although if I were creating a stock market today, I assume I would start differently than they did in the 17th and 18th centuries.
Well, and indeed, quite a lot of what you would do has in fact been done in the last few years, vastly more than ever was the case before, of trading is not actually happening, strictly speaking, on exchanges. The big investment banks have their own computer systems. Their computer systems can talk to each other, and they can work out ways to actually spend a little less and behave in a slightly more discreet fashion so that other traders can't see them coming if they trade off exchange. And that's another big part of the puzzle of why we have more volatility these days than perhaps was typical before.
Are there stock markets in all the countries with developed economies?
Yes, I can't think of any exceptions off the top of my head.
What about developing nations? Do they have them, or is there a certain requirement of a certain amount of economic activity?
There may be some exceptions, but it's fascinating quite how many markets have become available over the year. One of the big performers last year was the delightfully named Ho Chi Minh Stock Exchange in Vietnam, for example, and the whole concept of frontier markets has become one of the big buzzwords particularly in the last year, because the main emerging markets have become so closely correlated with the developed world. The idea has been search out bargains in smaller stock exchanges which may be somewhat less efficient but which are still showing signs of growth, and that way maybe you'll be able to find stocks that can continue to grow even if the world goes into the kind of global downturn which people seem to be scared of at the moment.
Who owns these stock exchanges?
Well, that's again a fascinating question to which the answer has changed in the last few years.
Because I hear about one stock, you know, a stock market buying another stock market.
Exactly.
It seemed outrageous to me.
Well, historically, they were treated as public utilities or as cooperative clubs which belong to the dealers. That's where you get the concept of seats on the exchanges. And that concept has only really gone away. While before you had the extent of telecommunications and computer technology that we now have, it was as close as you can get to a natural monopoly. You had to gather an awful lot of people together in one room to be able to have an efficient stock exchange. Therefore, there was a natural monopoly, and therefore, almost every economist would agree, therefore, it's best for it to be treated as a public utility. Once it became possible to start offering alternative venues and to trade electronically, the notion of maintaining a monopoly for particular stock exchanges begins to decline. Then it becomes conscionable to say, well, what are we charging for fees here if you're running an exchange? What if we actually decided we were going to run on a for-profit basis, given that we're competing with other people, we have other venues competing with us now? Now that there are still some exchanges, but that are still privately held or cooperatively held, but the vast majority are now public, and if you've invested in them, you've made an awful lot of money in the last few years.
Well, New York Stock Exchange, privately held, isn't it?
The New York Stock Exchange went public 2 years ago, and making obscene amounts of money, or very attractive amounts of money, depending on your point of view at the time. And since then it's merged with Euronext, which in itself was one of these sharks that eats up other sharks that had formed, I think, six different continental European stock exchanges. And they've only recently announced that they're going to buy the American Stock Exchange, which is not far away from us as we speak, which at one point was a competitor to the NYSE, but has now given up the ghost. It's one of the remaining stock exchanges that was still there, not publicly available on the stock market.
So we're seeing stock exchange conglomeratization. Mm. Joining us also is David Widener, who is a senior columnist at MarketWatch. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
David, what are the most successful stock markets in the world outside of the United States?
Well, you know, for a long time, it's been the big three. It's been the New York, the Tokyo, and the London Stock Exchange. And then there was kind of...
I was like the FTSE because the name is so cute.
Absolutely.
The Financial Times, indeed. Yes.
Exactly. You know, and those were the big three, and then there was kind of a second tier, and I think Euronext was definitely part of that, and then there's Hong Kong and Bombay simply by the number of listings, or Mumbai, the most successful, that's hard to evaluate at this point in time, because it's the playing field is changing so much, and there's so much. Some say the New York Stock Exchange has been diminished quite a bit, even though it's bought Euronext, because it can't even, it doesn't have a market share in its own listings. Its market share in its own listings has declined quite a bit. So it depends on how you define it. In terms of profit, I would say, you know, New York does very well. NASDAQ has a great business. Tokyo, of course, does well. So it depends on what your criteria is, literally.
Well, in other words, if we look at profit, then that is easier to figure out than some other things, like the power of an exchange. How much does the stock market reflect its country's overall economic success?
Well, that's very much so. And, when you think of the symbol of U.S. capitalism, you think of the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And the trading that goes on there, I mean, that's your visible symbol. And because of so much of the world's market capitalization of companies is listed there. This is something that in the last year has come up. You know, Dubai and, of course, the Middle Eastern economic power that we've seen from the sovereign nations there, they've wanted to get into the stock exchange game simply for that reason, for the prestige that goes along with having a dominant stock exchange, and they've been going out and buying exchanges as well.
Well, let's talk about what we've been seeing recently as indicative of something that we've seen over the course of my lifetime. We have a global downturn, and then suddenly there seems to be a domino effect, or in another case, a stock market starts booming and everybody else starts booming. Why does that happen?
I wouldn't say in this case that there was a domino effect, because I think we've actually moved in the last 10 years even beyond that. Certainly the Asian crisis in the late 90s, there was a distinct sense that once one went, the speculators moved on and had a look at another.
There are certain protections have been put on?
It's more that the underlying economy is now so truly global that it's difficult for the stock exchanges to reflect much great difference themselves. Nowadays, people are much more interested in the FTSE Euro first, which covers the whole of continental Europe, than they are in the original FTSE, for example. But if you look at where the earnings from the companies that are quoted on these exchanges come from, it's often the geography of where they happen to have their head office is of little or no interest. So, for example, I mean the most obvious sector for this is oil, which has always been the most globalized sector. You're interested in comparing ExxonMobil and Chevron to BP and Shell and Petrobras rather than to other American companies because they're in a truly global market. The same is true of tech companies. The same is true of large financial services.
But
companies.
Would they all be traded on the same stock exchange?
Well, as we've been discussing, increased to a greater extent than ever before, they are.
Well, multinational global companies that are publicly listed are listed on almost every exchange out there, and that is because their interests are truly global. So, you know, we have one world stock exchange, although we don't call it that. You know, trading moves around the globe with the sunlight. John Thane, who was head of the New York Stock Exchange, was considering opening the exchange earlier, and they abandoned that plan. But they were also considering, what about opening up 24-hour trading? And he was asked about that, and he said, people need to sleep. And so
I've heard commercials that suggest that you don't need to sleep, that if you go with us, you can be trading on the Indian stock market.
Well, wouldn't brokerages love for people to stay awake 24 hours and trade, and so they can earn their fees? I mean, that's kind of I think a very small minority, if that's happening at all, in terms of retail investors. But certainly, the big brokerages are 24-hour operations. I mean, they trade around the globe. Their strategies are global, and they simply move from where exchanges are open to the next open exchange.
Can you explain the efficient market hypothesis?
It's the idea that at any one time, all the currently known information about a stock is reflected in the current price. Therefore, it should go effectively on a random walk. If you can see that something good is coming up, you automatically discount for it. And so when that news happens, it shouldn't have that much of an effect. You need true surprises to move a stock. In the very long term, it's a very strong theory. Even in the short term, it's very meaningful. What it does mean is that you've now had a great move towards what's known as behavioral finance, which is exploring ways in which people can be predictably irrational, and therefore ways in which you can predictably move slightly away from the efficient markets hypothesis so that you can profit by moving it back towards efficiency.
So what is recent research into the psychological factors? Tell us about how prices shift.
Again, as you could probably guess, it shows that people are more prone to fees and greed and fear. Mm-hmm. What is interesting is this sort of comes from experimental psychological experiments. People will be much more prepared to take a gain than to take a loss, even though it frankly should be the same thing. None of us ever likes to actually close out on a loss. So we are all more loss averse than we should be. There are ways.
That sounds like Las Vegas.
Yes. Nobody. When you're down, you want to at least get back to the analogy is more or less perfect. When you're down, you want to at least get back to where you started. It's the will-o'-the-wisp that keeps gamblers at the tables, and you can make money by betting against the suckers who don't want to admit that they're on a bad bet. That's one of the classic things that behavioral finance has shown, that we all suffer from excessive loss aversion.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation on Please Explain about global stock markets. Also, take your calls at 212-433-9692. My guests are John Authors, the investment editor for the Financial Times, and David Widener, senior columnist at MarketWatch. We're talking about global stock markets on today's Please Explain with senior columnist at MarketWatch, David Widener, and investment editor of the Financial Times, John Authors. Whenever the market experiences a big jump up or down, The experts all provide reasons on the news shows. It could be anything from a bad earnings report from a major retailer or something that's happened in Iraq. Should I assume that they're just guessing and no one really knows the answer?
Well, there's certainly a fairly high risk that we're both in the game of trying to explain why markets are moved. It's a very high risk that will be the case.
Absolutely.
Sometimes you can explain.
Oh, you know, you hear the terms thrown around, profit taking this week. Mm. When the market rebounded, did a 600-point swing. The reason was it was oversold to begin with, so people were trying to get it back to a reasonable level. But the reality is that...
And then some other times that doesn't happen, and so nobody comes up with an oversold explanation.
Correct. And, you know, now, of course, the prevailing theory is that this rogue trader in France actually caused, panic in the markets and even may have influenced the rate cut by the Fed. So, We take our best guesses and based on the information we have.
Well, the rogue trader at Société Générale lost $7.6 billion for his company. But that's just a spit in the ocean, isn't it?
Well,
when we're talking about the kind of money that all of these different markets are involved in?
At the margin, I believe it was something like 10% of volume in the particular futures contract he was involved with for the first 3 days of this week in Europe, which is... which is fairly significant. Bear in mind, he didn't lose all that money. He accumulated what was looked like being quite a big loss, and then when they sold it into the down market, they turned it into a much bigger loss than it might necessarily have been.
Right, that was the final number, and you know the extent of the positions out there was certainly much bigger. And when you're talking about markets, I mean, we've kicked around the word rational today, but you know, markets certainly are anything but rational. It takes very little to set the market off in a direction.
So it's really often a reflection of investors' moods about the health of the economy?
Absolutely. I would totally agree with that.
Yes.
Well, but it was interesting to note that the U.S. market rebounded after the subprime crisis. Everybody said that this was going to be long-lasting. It turned out not to be. And then suddenly it collapsed again. Because of a rogue trader or is something else going on?
Not because of a rogue trader at all. We were down well more than 10% on the S&P before anything happened with the rogue trader. I mean, the big bounce last August was after the Fed started cutting, cut the discount rate, which is the rate at which it lends to banks, and set off speculation, which turned out to be correct, that it was going to cut rates further. And you had this brief period of a month or two when you had great hope that liquidity was going to really come to the rescue. It was going to be like 98 and 99 when the Fed was forced into cutting rates after long-term capital management, the hedge fund, imploded, and that created a rather false but rather fun while it lasted boom. That was the theory. The other part of the theory was that financial institutions had thrown the kitchen sink, to use the market jargon, at the problems that they'd had with the credit crisis, and that it was all going to be over in the third quarter. And of course, that turned out to be completely untrue.
So when the Fed lowers rates, foreign markets have a good day.
Well, absolutely.
Because the U.S. economy still have that much impact on the rest of the world?
Well, I think that was the surprise. I think the markets themselves knew that they depended on each other. But I think there was a feeling here in the U.S. that certainly the U.S. market was not as influential as it was. But of course, after all the hand-wringing and pundits have talked about this week, you know, the reality is that our consumer society, the fact that we are spenders and buying products overseas, means that we are still going to have an impact on the world economy.
Well, lowering interest rates is popular with investors, but aren't people who rely on savings hurt by those cuts? I mean, isn't it like any kind of medicine? There's always some kind of a side effect.
Well, nobody in this country saves, so I don't know.
Exactly.
Also, that's
and it lowers mortgage rates.
Well, but people who are on pension plans, for example.
And there really is the U.S. savings account is the American home. And that's why, you know, the issue of the subprime crisis and the diminishing home values in the U.S. mean that we are, you know, we're losing our buying power, and that's where the confidence crisis is coming from.
Well, the latest downturn has been described as being caused by fears of a recession. Mm. How is a recession even measured? Because job and labor numbers are notoriously misleading, aren't they?
Well, you always know that you've had a recession after the event.
I think the official announcement comes out 9 months after it starts, and you're usually on your way to the recovery when you get...
And the Times pointed out... The Times pointed out the other day that by the time Congress and the president get around to trying to fix a recession, the recession is already kind of over.
Yes, but that's been the historical experience. I think generally a recession can be a bit like pornography. You know it when you see it, the famous judicial definition. A lot of people in the market saw a number of different factors at once and came rapidly to a conclusion that, yes, we weren't going to be able to get through this without a... get through the problems with subprime, caused by subprime, without moving into a recession. The jobless data, you're quite right, is remarkably noisy, remarkably prone to revision. You just wonder where all these hundreds of thousands of people they missed could have been when they took the first count. But
well, I think
the jobless numbers suggest that the economy is slowing down very drastically, and that scared people.
And now the president is injecting $145 billion into the economy. There's big arguments over where that money should go, whether it should go to businesses, whether it should go. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, said you should only give it to people who are unemployed because they're sure to spend it immediately and invigorate the economy.
You know, I know that economists have talked about this number, but I know that in the past, after there have been tax cuts or rebates, that the economy does seem to have improved. But I really think we're talking about a confidence game, especially when we're talking about consumer spending. If a combined rate cut and a stimulus package inspires the market, or at least dampens the fall that the markets have been taking, people are going to feel a little more confident. And plus, knowing that they're going to have maybe $1,000 coming to them in a check in 3 months is going to give them a little more confidence. And I think that the psychology, you know, we've talked about behavioral psychology already on the show. That is the biggest benefit of a stimulus package. I don't think the number, the $150 billion or whatever it is really the issue.
My guests on Please Explain today are David Widener, senior columnist at Market Watch, and John Authors, investment editor for the Financial Times. Our number here is 212-433-9692. And before we go to those calls, a listener left a comment on our show page asking why the secondary market is so important, since none of the money that changes hands is going to the companies whose stock is being traded.
Why the secondary market in shares matters.
Yes.
It affects how they can raise money in the future. Mm-hmm. It affects whether they can be bought. And also the secondary market is hugely important because pension funds, all of us probably don't realize, are invested in that, and it has a real effect on wealth and wealth that can be spent.
Bruce from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my phone call. I don't understand why we don't just tighten our belts like Paul Volcker did in the late 70s and try to wring out the excess in the economy. We have to transition from a consumer-based economy right now where we're spending a lot of money we don't have to an economy where we're actually producing services and goods. And that's what I think.
Okay. Do you you want to respond to that?
Well, certainly spending is a big part of the debate right now, especially on Capitol Hill. And in terms of economic policy, and the Fed has been on a tightrope. It's been trying to stop inflation and appease Wall Street, which wants these big rate cuts. So there is serious debate exactly about how to soften the blow of this recession.
Well, what about in other countries? For example, we keep on reading that India's economy is booming, and yet during this latest round, the Indian market, the BSE Sensex, was hit hardest.
That's because of the big flows of international money that are flowing around, and because the Sensex, off the top of my head, was up something like 50 or 60% in a matter of months.
So it had gone too high.
I think all the markets have been really overvalued when you look at them over the last year. I mean, there's a lot of people who say that stocks are still very expensive, much like the U.S. home market is still very expensive in comparison to relative historical patterns. So
that's because interest rates are going down. If interest rates were higher, people might put their money into that rather than buy. As long as interest rates are low, people are likely to buy stocks, aren't they?
Well, within the particular markets of India and China, the authorities there are nervous because growth obviously always will carry with it the risk of inflation. They've been hiking interest rates very aggressively for more than a year now, and they haven't yet had that effect on their local markets. Right.
Do countries that have more controlling governments like China get involved in their stock markets more?
Well, China is a very different case from almost anywhere else on the planet. And yes,
because it's a socialist capitalist country, right? Which just seems impossible.
Are not like anywhere in the world, you know. So,
well, what about a country like Russia, for example, which also seems to where the screws seem to be being applied more and more by Vladimir Putin at this, and if he doesn't like the way somebody runs a company, he simply takes it over. But there's still a stock market.
It's what's known euphemistically as corporate governance issues. It's always given us in your list of bear points on the bull points are all the natural resources and the way the middle class in Russia is growing, blah, blah, blah. And then the bear point is corporate governance issues, which means the government might steal your company.
I would assume would make some investors rather queasy.
I think... Broadly speaking, there is. I was very startled. I did a column on this not so long ago. The single most popular world leader, if you go by the performance of their domestic stock market of this decade, is Vladimir Putin, and it's not even close. A lot of investors actually like stability. I'm not going to launch on a political defense of Mr. Putin.
You have to consider his starting point.
Like him. Yes, exactly. Oh, that's true. That's true. After, particularly if you've gotten a choice between Yeltsin and Putin, boy, do the markets prefer Putin.
Recently, we had Yegor Gaidar, who was the economist put in charge of the Soviet economy by Boris Yeltsin. He was the prime minister. And I asked him if he missed being in politics. He said no, because he was responsible for the transition. He said, they hate me. They'll never vote for me. So I guess the transition was difficult. Jim from Union City, New Jersey, how you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Putin. I've read that he's maybe worth $20 billion. And having pushed the oligarchs out of the way, he has various straw owners and various oil and gas enterprises. China's technically still a communist country. Would there be the possibility of political machinations to disrupt the economical so-called objective rationale?
Are we talking about China or Russia? Yeah. Or?
Well, China and Russia being movers. And you know, Lenin said that when we come to hang them, they'll sell us the rope.
Just one thought on that. I think that the relative stability in those countries over the last year has contributed to the overall rise in stocks around the world. And I think, you know, certainly political stability helps, absolutely. And any sort of disruption would set back, I think, the global economy and stocks globally.
And as for China, obviously it's a huge issue. The whole question of whether you can have something that looks like very real capitalism in the economic sphere, which you do have in China, overlapping with a total lack of democracy in the political sphere, is intriguing. What the Chinese in particular have an incredibly difficult balancing game opening their economy. The one thing you do have to say is, so far they've played it remarkably well. Whatever else they are, they're not dumb. But you're quite right. The risks of something horrible happening at some point there are obvious and keep a lot of people awake.
We have just seconds left, but is this all an example of globalization being impossible to stop? I mean, many people, there are economists out there who are arguing over whether globalization is a good idea and whether the world is flat or not. But the thing that we see, the interaction with all between all of these stock markets,
I think
isn't that a perfect example of globalism that is unstoppable?
Absolutely. It's here. I mean, globalization is here, and it's been here for a while, and it's only going to get stronger, the interdependence.
Thank you both so much for being with us. We've been talking about global stock markets on Please Explain with David Widener, senior columnist at MarketWatch, and John Authors, investment editor for the Financial Times.